This is the DRF Players Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the DRF Players Podcast. It's the July 21st, 2017 edition, show number 253. I'm your host, Peter Thomas Fornital, back with you, not in Saratoga Springs, but still in the Brooklyn bunker. And yes, as you might imagine, there's a story that goes along with that, which we will get to in a little bit in the form of a Tales from the Track style rant. But first, I want to introduce you to the distinguished panel for today's show. Joining us as always, once again, calling in from one of my favorite places in the world, North County, San Diego. He's the people's champion, Jonathan Kinchin. JK, what's up?
Man, I usually when I do this podcast, I'm the smartest guy in the room, but today I'm not going to be. No offense, Pete.
None taken. I've made fun of your ego enough that you deserve to get a line or two off like that on me every now and again. Speaking of that smartest man in the room, boy, JK and I, we thought we were hot stuff last weekend at the Bobby V's Winners Teletheater in Stamford, Connecticut. We did our show. We got lots of nice feedback. We had a wildly successful Periscope hit. By the way, podcast completists, go back in our timelines and check out the Periscope from last Friday at Stamford. It was basically sort of like an unplugged episode of the pod, though this one, unlike our dungeon appearances, is safe for work. But anyway, so we thought we were pretty cool. And then when it came up to one of the denizens there, a guy named Carlton, that we knew this next guest, we instantly achieved. It was like he was talking to Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, simply because we knew the man. He misses his daily analysis of New York racing so much. He may not be doing that anymore, but he is still a distinguished member of the Buyer team, and you can get his thoughts on racing pretty much whenever you want via Twitter at NTAMM1215. I'm talking, of course, about Nick Tamaro. Nick, how you doing today?
I'm doing great, Pete. I assume this whole conversation about Jonathan not being the smartest person in the room was because he was at the library or something. I mean, I didn't know about this whole this introduction, but I'm quite flattered by it. It's as if the red carpet had been rolled out.
There you go. Seriously, Carlton was like just wistfully saying, "Oh man, I miss Nick Tamaro. I miss reading his thoughts on Naira every day." And then JK had the phone out and you were talking to him and we made his ear.
That's only happened to me twice in my life. Once with Carlton being excited to talk to Nick, and then once when I was in London and some guy found out that I was MK's brother and got to talk to my brother. So I try to surround myself with celebrities.
I've used that one too. If you know, dance music is like a different thing in England. It's like much more, it's obviously a thing in our culture, but it's like a thing in England. And I have met multiple people who, when it somehow will come up, probably because we're talking music, and MK will come up, and I'll of course have to point out that my obnoxious podcast co-host is his brother, and it's, you know, freak out every time. So I can relate to that one. All right, so here's the story for today's show. We are going to talk about, we did our little Saratoga preview on Tuesday, but as several people correctly pointed out to me, we were a little light on the handicapping side of previewing the meet. So I want to spend a few minutes just talking about the Saratoga meet in general, what's different about it, what things we look for, et cetera, et cetera. Then, of course, we will talk about some racing. We'll talk about these two stakes at Del Mar on Saturday. We'll go over Saratoga's late pick four. But before we get to any of that, I got to tell you why I've sort of been down the bottom of a mental well over the last 12 hours. And it involves a guy who's been a character on this show before. You might know him as the Ice Cream Man, JK. He and I had plans, long-established plans, carefully worked-out plans to drive up to Saratoga last night. And there was a lot going on. I had a lot planned today, just to give you an idea. You know, the table was booked. More than that, a friend of a friend is a film student at NYU, and she was up there with all her equipment. She was going to film a little. We're going to do a little documentary, I guess you'd say, chronicling my opening day visit this year, an NYU alum, go Violets, from many moons ago. I'm not sure what exactly the angle was going to be, but you know, film crew up there waiting for me, made all these arrangements, and all packed, ready to go, and just waiting. And the guy's late. I figure, okay, Ice Cream Man, he can be a little flaky. He's a little late. Put on another episode of Better Call Saul and forget about it. That episode ends, and I'm starting to get a little nervous. I call him. He's looking for the car, okay? He's looking for the car. He wasn't sure where he left his car. So I'm like, okay, whatever. Get on your bicycle. Drive around the neighborhood. You're sure to find the car. Put on another episode of Better Call Saul. That ends. Still can't find it. I've got a friend helping me look. Starting to get a little nervous at this point. We get to the point where... I suggest to him, you know, you better call the pound, see if this thing, you know, maybe you parked it somewhere illegally, you got towed. Another hour passes before that actually becomes the solution. His car had been towed. We're completely hosed because I can't drive up in the middle of the night with all the stuff I had to do today, article to write, podcast to do. So I now ask you guys the question. It turned out it's not really his fault. It was the Ice Cream Man's brother who had parked the car, not him. So he is truly a victim in this as well. But still, for messing with a man's opening day at Saratoga, is it okay to just delete a friend from your phone and pretend he doesn't exist? JK, I'll start with you.
Well, I would imagine back in the day when the mob was a little bit more prevalent, people probably lost their lives for interfering with opening day at Saratoga. So... he's lucky it's a different generation.
Nick, can you offer any defense to this behavior?
I'm going to tell you this much, Pete. If you don't delete him as a friend, then I'm going to delete you as a friend.
All right. Well, there you have it. I've got my new plan for the day. I'm going to simply play from the phone. Oh, the other thing was I was like scrambling, you know, looking for buses. Everything's booked. Or looking for trains. Everything's booked. I did book myself on the bus. So I will now today be playing. The early pick five will be from the Brooklyn Bunker, and the rest of the day will be from the bus on the way up there. Very undignified. But I will still get to Saratoga, and I'm glad I'm going to, because tomorrow, the Naira Betts tent, I'll be doing a little pregame show from 11 to 11:35 with Mike Watchmaker, of course, the national handicapper of Daily Racing Form, and also our buddy Marshall Graham of 10 Strike Racing. So going to be great to get a chance to hear their thoughts on the card and the Saratoga meet in general. So I will get, you know, it ultimately is a case of better late than never. And in blunders by the Ice Cream Man, I still think this one may rank second to his tipping me on Green Grotto in the Carter. That was his opinion. He liked Green Grotto. He bet the race. He managed to not catch a ticket, despite the fact that the 3-5 favorite was second. That still may be more of a blunder than this. But anyway, enough about that. Let's move on to the Saratoga meeting. Nick, I'm going to start with you. All the years you've spent following Naira, writing about Naira intensely. When the horses go north, how does that change what you're looking at day in, day out? What are the biggest differences between Saratoga and the Belmont meet that precedes it?
The influx of horses from different locales obviously is significant at Saratoga, just simply with the Kentucky shippers, and you've got some upstate horses that come in from Finger Lakes and some of the lower level races. Primarily, you'll get that, you know, the Kentucky guys, some of the Floridians that end up coming up. Now that racing has changed a little bit and some of the power has shifted to other jurisdictions, it's a little different. So you want to obviously be apprised of those horses and try and keep up with Informulator using some of the charts and identifying maybe what were some of the stronger races that horses came out of. Because if you've been faithfully following New York racing, you kind of know who's who and who's been at what level and who the hot trainers have been, what angles work well, which were good races, which were bad races, maybe which were days where the rail was good, the rail was bad, speed was good, speed was bad, et cetera, et cetera. And so you have to just get reacquainted to a few more. Saratoga is a big horse for course track, and I learned that kind of the hard way over the years. There's not always a way that you can, not always a tangible thing that you can do with that. And it's easy for somebody to say that a horse who was previously 1-5 at Saratoga, you'll hear guys in the grandstand especially say, oh, he was a horse for course. You know, so it's not really one of those scenarios, but you definitely want to You want to identify horses that have benefited from being up there in the past and maybe are from barns that also do well. So those are the kind of main things. In terms of track configuration and surfaces and those things, we're going to see an increased number, at least based on the opening day card and a little bit on the weekend cards. We're obviously going to see an increased number of turf sprints. There have been more as years have gone by, but this racing office seems to like them very much. And as Doug Bradar, now famed jockey agent for Florent Giroux and longtime racing office employee, once told me when I asked him about why so many horses, why there are so many turf sprints, Doug informed me, he said, Nick, there are so many turf sprints because they always fill. Yeah. So there will be a lot of them and there will be, they're difficult races because the 6 and 7 furlong races that have been run at Belmont are vastly different. So what it will require you to do is understand a little bit of the pace scenario differently and to be very, very cautious of cutbacks. I have learned the hard way and the expensive way that cutting horses back on the turf, especially at 5.5 furlongs, is exceptionally difficult. So those are some of the ins and outs along with, and this is, of course, part of a larger conversation among the three of us and many others about rail positions and weather, given that Saratoga has shown through the years that when you have a prolonged dry period, the inner turf course can become extremely speed favoring. When the rail gets taken down, it will again become extremely speed favoring if you've got that that period of dry weather. So let's hope for just enough rain throughout the meet to make for some fair turf racing a little bit later on, because it can get a little frustrating by closing weekend when you've almost had enough, especially as a public handicapper, and now you're dealing with a kind of a biased surface.
No, that makes perfect sense. I always sort of think, you know, those Monday night, 3 hours of rain every Monday night at Saratoga. Wouldn't that be perfect? Just a little bit of natural watering to keep things fair, because we've definitely seen that phenomenon over the years as it gets sunbaked. A lot to unpack, a lot of very interesting points you made in there, Nick. One I wanted to follow up with is, do you find that there are trends from year to year regarding those shippers? For example, shippers from a certain area of the country overperforming or underperforming at Saratoga. I remember back in the day, and I don't think this is as prevalent now, but maybe it is to some degree, the Kentucky shippers, especially in claiming races, underperforming when they got to Saratoga. Do you see, do you think that trend is still a thing, and do you see any others of that ilk?
You know, the Kentucky question has been interesting because there were years where, quite honestly, the Kentucky horses were just throwouts. And I think that as Churchill has had to, I don't want to say redefine itself from a racing perspective, but at least has had to have some things adjusted because of the neighboring states with slots. And I think it required Ben Huffman, who's as good a racing guy as there is in the racing office of Churchill, to kind of perfect what their product would be. And they got down to a 4-day schedule with 8 on Thursday where he could utilize the horse population properly. I am going to be careful with the allowance types and am willing to give the claiming types a little bit more of a look. That being said, other than 2-year-olds, I'm going to want most of the Kentucky shippers to prove that they belong. Now, I think the 2-year-olds always fit because clearly the 2-year-old programs, as they're constructed in various locales, are just geared much more towards Kentucky than they are anywhere else. So you're going to have guys start their 2-year-olds at Churchill that live right in New York for more money, but they're mainly owned by people who don't care about what the purse money is. And they're at a track where, you know, training is almost uninterrupted all the time. And you've got, it's a haven for that type of stuff because a lot of those horses are broken in Kentucky and they just make it to the racetrack a little bit quicker. So those are the types that I'm always willing to say, yes, they're on par. I'm interested to see if the claiming and allowance types come around as frequently. We also generally, and there's a super interesting race tomorrow in the last, which I think we'll touch on, where two of the horses that are going to be pretty main players are coming out of a claiming race at Churchill on the turf. So that's going to be the kind of situation where you're like, man, is a 40 or 50 at Churchill on the turf going to stack up to a 40 or 50 at Saratoga, where you may have some allowance droppers, you may have a starter allowance mover, you may have a condition claimer move up from Belmont. So those are tricky, and I think you want to handle them with care. You want to almost treat them as individual incidences. The other thing that, of course, has to be mentioned is that now we're dealing with Gulfstream shippers at a rate unlike we've ever seen before, because they've sort of swooped in and taken a big place in the overall racing scene. And their racing has progressively gotten better in the post quote unquote championship meet era. And so you're now seeing better horses run there in May, June, and early July than you did previously. And you want to give those horses a look. So you don't want to just always discard them and always overlook them, because I think that the overall caliber of that racing has improved quite a bit. So it's hard to say a trend has developed, but clearly we're going to see them coming from different places, and we're going to need to handle them with care.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with Nick. And one of the things that I've noticed about Saratoga and Del Mar, and it's taken me probably 5 years of losing at those two meets to really understand that, is that you have to do a good job of digging deeper into the PPs and learning the story of a horse than you would if you're at like Belmont. You know, like if you're playing Belmont on a Saturday, I mean, I wouldn't advise it, but you could get away with looking at the last two or three races to kind of see the form of the horse and then make a decision based on that. When you're at Saratoga and Del Mar, you can't do that, because trainers, owners, they want to win there. And sometimes form will look dirty, and they will find that magic trick that gets this horse ready to run at this distance, at this day, on this surface, with this vet work, with all these situations. It's a very dangerous game to not really start at the bottom of the PP, work your way up, and really tell yourself the story as the owner. Why is this horse in this spot? I mean, a perfect example for it is the first today. I literally, in a normal situation at Saratoga, I mean, at Belmont or Santa Anita, I use two and that's it. But at Saratoga on opening day in the first race, like, it's not fear. It's just there's weird things that you're not going to see on the paper, and you have to be aware of them, because they're going to be the ones that are going to have you be that annoying guy who said, I can't believe I didn't use that horse. How'd that horse win? Oh, blah, blah. Just you got to kind of cast a slightly wider net, in my opinion, when you're playing Saratoga and Del Mar.
Do either of you guys know, was it the first race, was it the first race in the book as well at Saratoga? Because I think that, and I don't know if it was or it wasn't, but that can have an effect as well. If somebody knows a race is going to be the first race at Saratoga and it's a claiming race, I think it's very likely you're going to see a particularly salty group, because people want to win that race. It's something you'd remember for your entire life, even if it's a lower level race, and that could lead to the kind of angles that that JK is talking about. I think that's a great point, and I've heard it described. Mike Maloney describes Saratoga as a meet that's more about angles than a typical racing meet, which you can usually use fundamentals of handicapping and form study. There's more going on here, and I think what Mike is talking about is similar to what you're on about there, JK.
Yeah, no, I agree. I'm not much of a I've transferred my angle portion of my game. I try not to be too much of an angle guy, but I completely agree. At these two places, you know, it's definitely, because you want to know what do guys do well, because whatever it is that they do well, they're gonna absolutely try to do it at Saratoga and Del Mar to get into those winner circles. And so other than Kentucky Derby, I would imagine that some guys would probably rather win races at Saratoga or Del Mar than win some grade threes around the country.
It's possible. I heard a New York horseman once say that a win at Saratoga is worth three at Belmont. And I think when you go through and you read the PPs, trying to understand the story of each horse from back to front, like you're suggesting, JK, that's an important piece of information to keep in mind.
100%. And another topic that I think it's fair to discuss while we have Nick on, because especially with Saratoga getting started, and it was an annoying topic of conversation last year, and I wanted to breach the subject a little bit because of Nick's knowledge of the game and how things work, because I think that it's exceptional, and I think that he can speak on this better than most, but also his relation to this person. I wanted him to talk a little bit about the morning line, and obviously last year Travis got some annoying comments, which if no one knew it was Travis doing it, no one would have said anything, which is silly. So I wanted Nick to kind of talk a little bit about Travis's qualifications for doing that and kind of how it works and why he's doing as good a job as anybody.
So I get the this is like being the White House press secretary almost. you get the you get to answer all the questions while everybody else has the fun and makes the money. But I kid. You know, the internet is such a great place, and you don't obviously need any qualifications to have a Twitter account or to offer comments about a variety of things. And the most hilarious thing to me about people mocking a morning line is that if you are not able to go through a race and identify with a reasonable level of certainty how you think it's going to be bet, then you're a sloppy fool who's attempting to blame somebody else for your own deficiencies. So if you go through a race and you honestly think a horse is going to be 15-1 and a morning line maker makes the horse 15-1 and that horse goes off 6-1, that's probably something a little bit more than what all of you were noticing. And you probably want to pay even more attention to it. So I laugh at the whole thing. Travis is somebody who's been in the game for, like me and like a lot of people around our age, has been involved in it forever, grew up in upstate New York. So he's been going to Saratoga since he was a little kid and had some morning line experience down at Louisiana Downs. And it was a job that they offered him last year. And so I think he did it very, very well. Did he have some that he missed on? Yeah. And Eric Donovan had some that he missed on the year before and the year before that. And Eric Donovan had some that he missed on at Belmont. And Eric would be the first one to admit to you. And Eric is probably the best morning line maker out there. So, you know, this is how it goes. This meet is under a microscope in so many ways. And it ends up being a situation where almost regardless of what goes on the rest of the year or in the rest of your career, you kind of get defined by Saratoga. So people took exception to a couple of lines last year where, including one where Travis made an Ingrid Mason 2-year-old first time starter 20-1 and the horse ended up going off 7-2. And the hilarious thing about it is it took until I think the horse's fifth or sixth career start to break its maiden. And it may have even gone off less than 7-2. It really is neither here nor there. And it was like, oh, I mean, he had basically ruined the entire day. You know, there were all of these people, all of these internet titans were ready to just send it in on 747 at 20-1 because they had no idea that a 9-4 worker at Ocala with blazing fast workouts at Arlington in a Pletcherless 2-year-old race on Alabama Day could possibly go off 9-5.
To me, it's,
so these
it's,
are the kind of things that you deal with.
It's good information.
I just don't know why people care.
Yeah, well, that's a whole separate question. Why people care is, I think, because right. You're an easy target. And in all my years in the racing, here's a phrase I don't think I've ever heard. Hey, great morning line in that third race. Like, it just, you only notice, it's the kind of thing where you could do such a great job 9 times out of 10, and then the 10th time is the time that you'll know. If you're doing your job, nobody knows. It's one of those jobs, and there are others. If you're doing your job right, nobody notices. But like, to me, it's almost
you're 100% right. Yeah, you're 100% right. And I was actually going to say on that specific statement, it's like when you're in the grocery store and you go up to the manager. Everybody, what does everybody who goes up to a manager in a grocery store say? They complain. They have some kind of complaint to make. Nobody is ever going to walk up to a manager and say, "Boy, everything was lined up perfectly on the shelf today," or "Oh my God, this level of service was incredible." So it's the same kind of thing. It is the ultimate thankless job. And Travis being sort of the you know, into self-degradation as much as every other horse player has taken it on again. And here he is, lined up, ready for the firing squad.
I have heard JK ask grocery store managers, "Where's the ice cream?" That's the only non-complaint I think I could think of. But it's, I also think you can argue that, all right, maybe the Ingrid Mason one, what was that horse, 747, something like that?
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe you could call that a miss. Maybe he could have intuited some information based on the sale work and the Pletcherlessness of the race that 20 was too high. But whatever the right number was, the horse was less than that. And I think that's okay, because part of what I want, yes, the morning line is supposed to be a prediction of what the crowd will do. But I think you can argue to some degree, it's like what you should expect the crowd to do, and therefore when horses are bet under that, that's like good information to have. Well, obviously they like this horse, you know. It's not, I don't think, you know, you'd need a crystal ball to do it precisely, and I think that's you know, maybe Travis holds that up as the as what he wants to do is get everyone exactly right. It, that same idea in the pursuit of the Lombardi quote, in pursuit of perfection, perhaps we'll achieve excellence or something like that. But you know, realistically, it's something that, you know, you can argue that bar is just way too high to begin with. But we'll see. It'll be fun. We'll have Travis on the show at some point. He's going to join me in the Naira Betts tent for one of these Saturdays, which is going to be a lot of fun. We have a time for another minute or two of general Saratoga chatter before we dive into the specifics of races. I don't know, JK, do you have anything specific that you look at?
I do. Yeah, I wanted the boss man to talk a little. Oh, the boss man. We call him the boss. Our friend Mike Epps was on. We were running around in 2015 on the tour. Nick wore these glasses one time and looked like an. He looked like an absolute old time mobster. And so, so my friend Mike started calling him Nicky the Boss. So I just call him the boss sometimes for short. If you were wondering who I was talking to. Now I wanted to ask the boss man what he thought. If he could kind of talk a little bit about the differences. And the turf courses there, because I know that a lot of people get excited about, oh, well, the inner is for speed. And blah, blah, blah. So I wanted him to kind of give his breakdown of how he looks at those two different surfaces.
Yeah, great question. You know, and the melon, I believe, is starting to meet with the rail at zero. And the inner is going to start at 12. No, I'm sorry, opposite way. Inner is going to be at zero. Melon's going to be at 12. And the stakes are going to be on the melon today and tomorrow. They are... You know, my impression of the melon turf has always been, other than that week or so late in the meet, sometimes even as early as Travers, where we'll see a prolonged period of dry weather and, you know, and you'll see a lot of dust getting kicked up and horses just kind of don't come back to the field. The melon's a pretty fair course. When the rail goes out, it's a little bit more difficult to make that outside move. Maybe speed's got a slight bit of advantage. But then going to the inner, speed does have a bit more of an edge in the inner. The mile races on the inner can tend to be a little goofy. You can have some horses get a little brave on the front end. Losing ground is a big risk. It's best, of course, if you can save ground and pop outside, make a run down the middle of the track. But, you know, I mean, I'm not really talking about anything specific there. That's kind of the best option with turf racing in general. So I think one of the things turf-wise that people need to be aware of, and the best piece of advice I can give in terms of handling turf races that just were run at Belmont, when the rails came down on the inner turf course, both Belmont week and the week of Stars and Stripes and into the end of the meet, the inside part of that turf course was exceptionally strong. So I think you want to be very careful in replays that you don't upgrade anybody who was inside. You want to upgrade anybody who was outside, especially outside and trying to rally from off the pace. So just keep an eye on that. And as far as the turf courses go at Saratoga, just hope that we get some reasonable and aggressive riding occasionally so that every race doesn't just turn into the merry-go-round that makes me say things on Twitter that gets people upset, and then I get upset too, and that's not any fun.
No, nobody wants to be upset. That's not where we want to go with this Saratoga meet at all. One other angle I'll throw out there for consideration on the turf, particularly in any turf route, I'd say, but particularly in longer turf routes. We were talking before about horses coming from certain places overperforming. I do think the Fair Hill shippers, for whatever reason, probably because of all the bottom they can get with all the different training options they have at the Fair Hill Training Center, those horses tend to run a little bit better than the bare form suggests. That's another angle I would throw in there. And I think it's one of these things where, you know, the Belmont turf races... so many of those turf races are run in that unusual sort of one and a half turn configuration. Just being cognizant of horses who do more in a mile turf race on the inner, for example, it could be a different kind of horse that's going to be able to adapt to doing that much running around the tighter turns there. And I think, I mean, for you, Nick, does that all fall under the umbrella of horse for course stuff, or do you have any other specific thoughts about any other differences, horses who might do well at Saratoga on the turf as opposed to downstate?
Yeah, I think that has something to do with it. I think that's reasonable. I don't know if you can always, you know, make it something tangible, but I think it's something to keep an eye on. And if you, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with guys winning in Saratoga maybe that don't win at the rate that they do everywhere else. and they happen to be stable in Saratoga, like a Jimmy Bond. Now, Jimmy Bond's horses are probably going to run a little bit better upstate than they do anywhere else, simply because he's based there. And you'll get a little bit of that from Nick Zito. Of course, Zito's barn's not as strong as it was in the past, but, you know, he's probably going to put across a price at some point. And, you know, being at home and being able to do that, those are kind of – those are, I guess, a larger horse-for-course type angle, but they generally have to do with just that whole Saratoga vibe. I think the biggest horse-for-course angles that you'll see will really be on the dirt, but there will be some on the turf too. And you might find somebody like Buffalo Miss running today that maybe is at her best going 5.5 at Saratoga, where she really just exploded last year, and perhaps off the layoff she'll be ready to do something like that again.
All right, JK, any other general thoughts before we start talking about some racing?
I do have a general thought. I was looking on Twitter this morning. I don't know what drove me there. I guess maybe I saw his name show up in a timeline. June 17th was the last time that Duke Matisse tweeted without replying to something. The over-under I am setting for Duke to tweet is the fifth race tomorrow. Go.
I'll take the under.
Under.
Bad
under,
line.
Under.
Talk about a bad morning line. That's a cinch.
The book is so exposed right now. They're going to be stealing Duke's electronic devices to make sure he can't get to Twitter. I mean, you would have had to put. I think you could have put third race today and made the under -140 and still gotten action on it.
Yeah, I think the best. I should have probably said it at the first when the first turf race goes official. That's probably when I should have sent it. I should have done it because that's what's going to get him going when someone gets loose on the lead.
For those who want to follow JK's bet along, he's just at Duke Matisse on Twitter, isn't he? Doesn't he just have his name? One of those lucky souls.
He's a funny Twitter follow.
And for those who don't know, of course, he's been on the podcast multiple times. Professional horse player, extremely accomplished tournament player, and a good guy all around. Perhaps we'll press him into service at some point to do something for us on the podcast. All right, guys, I think we should dive into these races, especially since we're going to look at six of them. Though the one's going to go really fast. Shall we do Del Mar first, since it's been all Saratoga so far? You guys good with that?
Yeah, I'm fine with it.
All right, let's start with the headline, and this ties into a Twitter question that we received. And it also is yet another over-under, so it's a good segue in that regard as well. If the buyer for Arrogate in the San Diego were set at the line for what the buyer will be was set at 115. Would you go over or under? Nick, since you're the speed figure maker among us, we'll start with you.
I'm going to go under on that. I get the feeling that if at a mile and a 16th with Arrogate's engine really just getting cranked, I don't think it's going to be one where he's pushed to go that fast. I'm not one of those people that's always like, oh, well, he wasn't even cranked and all of those. I think horses operate at top speed because that's the only way they know about going. But I'd say under, that's a relatively kind of slow group that's in there with him. So I think it might be difficult to expect any of them to make a 10 to 12 point improvement in order to give him that 115 or so. Of course it will. Arrogate's one of those horses that he's one of those horses that speed figure people like, that everybody likes, but speed figure people like too, because he's just kind of an auto 110 and up. So I'm kind of expecting him to do that because he's just fast. But I would imagine that if I could bet the 115, if I could bet over 115 in the Pacific Classic, I'd take that in a heartbeat. He can create some separation on those horses. But I think tomorrow he'll get the job done. I'm going to guess he's going to come in at about a cool 109.
I like it. I like it. JK, what about you? Over under 115? I know he's a favorite of yours.
Yeah, I think under. I mean, I just worry about the distance, you know, being a little bit sharper for him. You don't get me wrong. It's not that he can't win at a mile in the 16th, but he hadn't done it since he was an allowance horse, and Christo was a length away from him that day. So I think it's probably fair to say it's not his optimal distance. No one's going to be mad at him about it. I would imagine there'll be some sarcasm when it comes in a 109 with people trying to say that, oh, no one's mad at him like they were at Songbird. But I don't think that he'll crack the 115 mark in this race. But I don't think that's an indication of the type of horse that he is.
Did you have a chance to see him in the flesh? He was schooling in the paddock yesterday, wasn't he?
Well, I had three phone conversations yesterday with people that said, who do you like today? And I said, I'm not at the track. And then everyone was like, everyone gasped.
Who are you and what have you done with Jonathan Kinchin?
Yeah, I'm sure you guys are going to gasp as well, too. No, I just figured I owed myself a day of not attacking it. The bar tab on the veranda on opening day was one that I think you guys would be impressed with. I mean, we had a pretty busy table with Tom Lute and Bill Sadu stopped by. Aaron Grider came by the table. There was a lot of people stopping by, and we attacked it. I would say, and so I took the day off, but I'll be back in action the next 3 days.
Let's keep it on the San Diego for a minute, Nick. I'll ask you. I think we're going to just all assume we have the winner. Is there any other wagering angle or exacta or clever horizontal bet, or is this just a pure watching race for you?
This will be a watching race. I'll probably just assume that he's going to get the job done. And I've always tried. I've been a proponent in the past of the small field, big price under the favorite kind. But I mean, if you're doing that, then who are you playing the exact Dalmore? You know, it almost feels as if there's a pretty high likelihood that it's a Baffert exacta and it's him over Cat Burglar. Or, I mean, I guess there's going to be a little bit of accelerate love in the underneath slot. So I don't really think, other than maybe playing a Kinchin style cold trifecta or maybe $100 wheel or something, that there's a whole lot of opportunities there. I think what you're supposed to do is, if you're a pick six player, obviously you're supposed to let it turn into the pick five that he turns it into and maybe play around there. Or the pick four pool in California is always just so gigantic. And it felt, just from my very brief glance at the races around it, like the sequence was pretty interesting, that you're just supposed to kind of grant that he's going to win this race and maybe try and bomb away on that pick four.
JK, any wagering thoughts on the San Diego? And if not, just go ahead and segue right onto your thoughts on the Eddie Reed.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the fun thing to do in this spot is to try to turn the 1-9 Arrogant into an even money shot. And the only way you can do that is by hooking him up in some pick threes and doubles with your other opinions. And those have to be right, of course. But that's what I would like to do, because, look, we all have it in us. We wouldn't do this game. Racing is more fun to watch. It's just a slightly bit more fun to watch when you got a little action on it. So I want to be alive to Arrogant when he turns for home, even though it should be exciting regardless. So I'll try to play some doubles and pick threes into him to try to get somewhere around even money and move on from there.
As for the Eddie Reed?
Eddie Reed, look, if you're playing the musical jock game, which a lot of people are going to play, they're going to find that Flavian Pratt lands on Hunt, and they're going to wonder why he got off of Kinji Storm and that why he got off of Up With The Birds. I like both of those horses more than I like Hunt. I feel like Kinji Storm is going to push Ashley Love Sugar, who is best when on the front end, and I'm going to look for Up With The Birds to finally kind of get a pace to run into. He's been chasing slow paces the last two times since he's gotten Phil D'Amato's barn. Actually ran into the owner of this horse on Thursday night.
Uh-oh,
and
here we
I
go.
Asked him why. No. I just asked him why Pratt was off, like, to know if Pratt made the choice. And he said that they wanted to try to get a change for luck, and that's why they switched to Jamie. I don't know if that's him spinning it or not, but either way, I'm okay with Jamie in this spot. They're going to get some pace to run into, and so Up With The Birds at a big price for me.
Nick, your thoughts. Have you run into any of the owners at cocktail parties lately?
Yeah, no, I posted a shameful tweet last night, which is uncharacteristic of me, but Jay Privman, who probably was annoyed by the tweet, but he only started following me a couple of months ago, so I had to tweet to him. So even though we've been friends for years. So he was saying that Bert Vacherak was at the track yesterday, and I think one of his horses won. And so I tweeted and said that Bert was the entertainer at a charity benefit I went to for a charity my parents were involved in years ago. And we were at a dinner at a cocktail party the night before, and I was probably 14 or 15 years old. And so I walked over to him and started talking to him about racing, and he talked to me about Soul of the Matter longer than he talked to anybody in the entire place. So it was my one experience. Like, that was my brush with stardom. So I know I've not run into any of the owners. There's a chance that maybe somebody from Samsung could be down summering in Houston, but I doubt it, given that their geographic proclivity. I bet Hunt last time, he ran awfully. So I can't see anybody, and I will be absolutely flabbergasted. And I think Phil D'Amato is just as good as anybody out there. I'll be shocked if this horse wins at a mile and eighth. So it's going to take quite a bit more than I think he has to offer. I was Captain Obvious here. I mean, I thought Ashley Love Sugar was probably too good for these horses. I mean, this is a pretty hungry group outside of Ashley Love Sugar, to be honest. And unless you believe that Mr. Rory maybe can get clear of this field and get a little bit brave, because other than Kenja Storm, he probably is not going to get pushed along too much. I just kind of felt like Ashley Love Sugar would get the right trip. It's cool to me that Up With The Birds is still a functional and you know, graded stake caliber racehorse, because he was a nice three-year-old years and years ago. He won the last running of the Jamaica before it became the Belmont Derby. So that's how far back he was running good races. He won it in October of 2013. So I'm interested to see how this plays out. I'm mostly going to be just an observer, because I think that Ashley Love Sugar will probably just win.
Most people meet Burt Bacharach, they're going to talk about Hal David, they're going to talk about Dionne Warwick, maybe throw a little Elvis Costello in there. Nick Tamro meets him. Afternoon Delights. That's the conversation. I absolutely love
it. That's right. I wanted to talk to him about the Super Derby and races like that, you know?
And that's why it's one of those things. Like, that's probably music to his ears in that context. All right, let's talk Saratoga, gentlemen. We're just going to look over this late pick four. We've got about 20 minutes, a hair less, to go over these four races. So we can't go super duper in depth, but we do have time to at least give our general thoughts. I'm going to rely heavily on, I have a couple of thoughts, but I'm going to rely heavily on you guys, as instead of doing the full work that I meant to do on this card, I spent my time banging my head against the wall, cursing the ice cream man last night. But anyway, all that said, Nick, as the guest, let's start us off here. How are you going to approach the eighth race at Saratoga on Saturday?
This was a really interesting group. And, you know, this is going to be a situation where we go back to the whole morning line conversation, because I think Travis is going to get some heat on this morning line, which he will in general and undeserved a numerous amount of times too. But you have a horse in here, Browse, who everybody sort of noticed that the ride last time, and I'll be as diplomatic as possible because this is a high quality program, and it was curious. It was odd. And I think it was Joel trying to be a little cute, which he does at times, and he'll take horses back somewhat unnecessarily, but the ride stunk, and he gave her no chance to win. And she's the kind of horse that you're just supposed to chalk up to, well, it was bad luck and I'll bet on it next time. It's just going to be a matter of how many people bet on it this time. So I think she's the type who will really be pounded. I'm not talking like favoritism, but I think she'll probably be in the 4-to-5-to-1 range. And she becomes a lot more interesting if she's asked for some speed, because there's not a whole lot of pace in this race. And it's at that quirky 1 mile distance. She can probably position herself very close to Volatility Index or potentially Now Power if Brian Lynch convinces Leperu to try and get her clear. So it's mainly for me going to be, I'm going to have to bet Browse based on the trip that she had last time. I will use Volatility Index a little bit. I'll use Penn Jade a little bit more. I'll use Price to Perfection probably as a backup, because this isn't generally a group that you can move up off of. It's her start, first start for Grand Motion. And I'm obligated to use Joy Othello a little bit too, because she ran some good races against better competition last year.
Do you give any count, Nick, to Stella Rose, where Rosario ends up? Just another horse who I feel like maybe hasn't been given the best of chances based on the trips in the last two. Or is that just too difficult to post and too many others in here?
No, Stella Rose is an interesting horse, because it really felt like coming into Travers Day last year when she won that allowance race that she was going to be a real dangerous three-year-old filly in some of those fall stakes races. And then she just kind of fell apart. And I'm still waiting for her to get back to that level. And this may be the spot. I'm wondering if maybe she'll let Rosario know to take a good look at Browse when he got off of her, because that was as close as he would get to her again. So I think that may be why he's on Stella Rose. But it is interesting. She's going to have to overcome a tough outside post. And it is difficult going a mile on the inner. The run to the first turn's not that long. So you do have to be careful about losing too much ground.
That was just one thing out of my notes I thought worth sharing in this race. JK, how about you?
Well, I got a question and a thought. The question is, do they think that the prize for perfection situation is going to suddenly be solved, switching her to Motion because Motion had Miss Temple City, or is there a purchase, or am I missing something here?
I hadn't heard.
I believe that was a Sasek Tipton sale. So I think that's where she was purchased. I can probably find out. And that's what I'm under the impression of, because it actually, she's now owned by two ownership groups that of course have many horses with Chad Brown. So it was simply getting out of Seth Klarman's ownership. And so I'm thinking they sold her at Sasek Tipton. So we'll see. And she is a Fulton Miss Temple City. So it'll be interesting.
Right. So for me, it's, you know, we talk about this all the time, and I know Nick and I have talked about it, you know, off there too, is, you know, a lot of times with these jocks, the post position and the jockey can tell you what's going to happen. And Julian can sometimes be a little bit of a puzzle to figure out, but if he does not send this horse from the 11, he's going to get a wide trip and he's got no shot of winning. Brian Lynch has obviously been going well. If you skip the Keeneland race, and you look at the last four races for Now Power, all of those were pretty, you know, manageable pace situations, and the horse ran on well. I think that he'll run well today. We've talked about it a million times. I love when Julian is on the front end. When he gets there, he doesn't get there very often, but when he finds himself there, he does a really good job of kind of rationing some speed and finishing. So at a big price, I'm going to use Now Power in a race that feels like there's not a lot of pace. I don't feel like Johnny's going to send and go to the front. Does it feel like Javier would send and go to the front with Volatility Index? It's like he would just kind of stick down in there. So I just kind of, you know, project that Now Power will be loose on the lead at a big price with a trainer that I trust and a jockey who can finish.
She's an interesting long shot if there's some speed in the course. It is a mile on the inner, so you might have that going for your advantage as well. Certainly an interesting idea for tournament play as well. Let's move on to the Sanford, the first stake of the Saratoga meeting. JK, we'll keep it with you.
Yeah, little meat problem. I'm back. You know, I did my little out of the gate thing, and I singled Direct Dial. I love that race that he ran at Keeneland. And then, you know, I'm going to forgive that he wasn't exactly where you wanted to be. It wasn't anything crazy, but not where you wanted. He wasn't on the part of the track you wanted to be in. In the last start at Belmont, I think that's the Tremont. Was that the Tremont?
It was.
Yes. Anyway, I love Direct Dial in the spot to run back to the race he ran at Keeneland. He gets Jose Ortiz. I think Asmussen horses are always going to improve with more time that they get because he's not really that hard on them in the mornings. And so I would expect this horse to just continue to get better. Admiral Jimmy made a really wild run. I was against that horse that day. So I wouldn't ignore him completely. But Direct Dial is going to be where the majority of my investment goes.
All right. You're referring to wild run and also against the track for Admiral Jimmy, right? If I'm remembering correctly, in the Tremont.
Yeah, he was all in. I mean, from what I remember, he was being pushed on early. But it's one of those things you can see from a Todd horse from now and then. They look like they're in trouble and they find another gear.
Nick, where are you going in here?
You know, I thought this race was tricky. The two Asmussens, obviously, towards the outside, look like they've got the majority of the speed. And Direct Dial is a very, very fast horse. So I thought Direct Dial ran extremely well in the Tremont. Probably was a little closer to the rail than you want it to be. Not quite on the rail, but close enough to it. And he really buried the Salamanazar that looked so good at Keeneland breaking his maiden. And he could not hold up with Direct Dial at all. So he becomes dangerous as the outside speed, and I think that's kind of where he's the horse you're supposed to trust most. I'm interested in Psychoanalyze. I know he'd be kind of a weak field, and this is a little bit of a speed figure sucker play because his race came up fast on everything. You know, it was one of those where just I may work for Bayer, but I'm going to look at everybody's figure possible to see if it came up fast across the board. So he didn't make out great at the post draw. Brian Lynch is the type of trainer that I don't really take anything for granted with, and I think he can have this horse ready to run well enough at second asking to maybe be able to rate just off the pace if necessary, if somebody does clear him. Or I could see Luis Saez really trying to take the bull by the horns out of the gate and maybe get clear of them early. So, you know, he's my pick. I'm going to use a few horses and all the gimmicks. I can't allow myself to be beaten by some of the ones who have shown the ability to come from off the pace too, because I think that that's such a such an asset this early in the game and going six furlongs as well, where a lot of these races just end up being a between a number of hungry horses at the eighth pole.
For a two-year-old race, a number of these have a two-year-old stake. A number of these have actually shown that ability to pass horses you're talking about, Nick, which isn't always the case in a race like this. So that's an interesting factor to consider. Another thing, of course, last year the rail not so good on opening day. Interesting to see if sometimes those trends can be year over year. Last year it seemed kind of random. I wouldn't expect that to be the case, but by the ninth race at least we'll have some idea, and that might affect the chances, or should affect the chances, of a horse like Psychoanalyze. All information we can continue to take in as we get closer to this opening Saturday, which will culminate really the climax of the day, the Grade One Diana, one of the signature races of the Saratoga meet, and we have a real star participating in Lady Eli. She's won at Saratoga before, obviously, that maiden win that turned so many heads. Bit unlucky, I thought, last year, not to get to the winner's circle again. What do you think of Lady Eli's chances in here, Nick? You think she's going to get the job done for Chad Brown?
I mean, there's no doubt she's the favorite. You know, she's a very deserving heavy favorite, and she's just one of the coolest horses you're ever going to find because of all that she's overcome and the things that she's done throughout her career. One of the things that I think is interesting about Lady Eli, and I was talking to Steve Bick about this earlier, is that we've kind of seen some of the developmental changes in her as she's gotten older. And one of the horses I always bring up with everybody when you're talking about older mares that may reinvent themselves in terms of running style is Royal Delta, who, you know, as a three-year-old was a big one-run closer. And then as a four-year-old, she showed some signs of it and even won the Breeders' Cup Distaff wire to wire. And as a five-year-old, she was basically a speed horse. And I kind of see that happening with Lady Eli. And I hope that Erato Ortiz, who is generally a guy that likes to be a little bit more conservative early, is able to let her do that, because I actually am not going to be surprised if she finds her way to the lead. And I make that argument because she was close to a very sharp pace last time. And when he rated her two back at Keeneland, she did not care for it. And I think that it ultimately made her unable to get the job done. And I think that little battle early was enough for Dickinson to overcome her late, even as just a high quality of horse as Lady Eli is. So if Dickinson, who Paco Lopez seems to have gotten comfortable allowing her to rate just off the pace and kind of get in that Paco pocket, for a pun intended, right in behind the lead. If he does not want the lead, and my impression is not a speed horse by any means, not that Lady Eli is a speed horse particularly, then I could see her ending up very forwardly placed in here. I think she'll be tough from wherever she's positioned. I think that a mile and an eighth at this stage of the game is probably the exact distance that she wants. It's probably always been her best distance thereabouts. But of course, I mean, even though Lady Eli is in there, the interesting horse in here is Antono. We want to know what Antono has. You know, was it just a game, which was about as impressive a turf performance as I have seen in America recently, if that was real. You know, is she going to be as good at a mile and an eighth? Is she going to be good maybe with not a lot of pace in front of her? All things considered, she didn't have much pace in front of her last time. That was a rock solid turf course that yielded a six furlong time of 105.4, and they almost went 47 flat for the half. So she was against the setup. She made her move on the inside, which maybe we're going to find out that she's a little bit of a rail rat that needs to be inside. I just want to see what she has to offer. I mean, I'm going to use both of them equally. I'm going to use Dickinson too in any multi, because I just think that there's too many obvious elements to discard her. But it's a tremendous opportunity for Antono to really prove that she's able to compete with the best of what we have in that division.
That was an amazing race last time. I was watching from down by the turn in a grandstand seat, going old school through the binoculars. And I was following Antono, who I had, of course, mentioned on the show, and was interested just to see how she was going to run. And I stopped watching, like, put the binoculars down. She's just too far back. There's no way she can get there. Like, move the binoculars to see what was going on in the lane, and who's this green and pink streak coming up the rail? Oh my God. Had to watch the replay to see what had happened. And indeed, she just flew home there. And she's going to keep my sympathy, even though I imagine, Nick, a lot of people will be using her as the big alternative to Lady Eli, who I certainly am not going to let beat me. JK, how do you see the Diana?
Well, I hope I see it right, because this is honestly going to be the race that decides whether or not I go to Chipotle tomorrow night for dinner, or if I
if I get to go
to La Jolla and sit on some balcony and have a steak, because I cannot wait to bet Antino in this spot. I love Lady Eli. I respect her immensely. She's not going to knock me out of multi-race situations, but the bulk of my investment is going to be on Antino. She was closing into a slow pace. To all accounts, I know they always liked her, but they didn't really think they didn't know if she was quite ready last time. If she wasn't ready last time and she's ready this time, I think she destroys this field. I think she's going to make it. I mean, that run she made at the inside last time was something extremely special. And so looking forward to watching her run. I wish she wasn't going to beat Lady Eli. But once I place my wager, I hope that's the case.
The way they bet her, somebody knew she was ready, I will suggest. whatever that word you heard.
Well, she was 3-1, and it's a Chad, so 3-1 on a Chad it's a little light, isn't it?
I don't know. Off that nondescript form, I think she was 10-1. Not nondescript form. That's harsh. But the Euro form wasn't anything like to scream about. I mean, I don't know. She was like 10-1 on the morning line. I thought she was bet. But, you know, neither here nor there. She's obviously well meant in this spot, and all of us, I think, will be happy if she gets the job done, and all of us will be happy if we see Lady Eli win. So it's a short field, but it's a cool, interesting iteration of the Diana with some real star power. We got about 3 minutes left. That should be enough time to talk about the nightcap and how we're going to close out this pick for JK. Why don't you go first?
Yeah, Nick can speak to this. I know he's a subscriber to this, and I know you are as well, Pete. But when you look down at the PPs on Timeform US and you see a lot of the blue pace figures for horses that were coming off the pace, they're automatic bets for me, because all they're signaling you to is that a horse was closing into slow fractions, and we all know that that's one of the best trips to bet off in turf racing. And so you got Mike Maker going two turns. You get Jose Ortiz on opening day. You got a Ken and Sarah Ramsey horse in for a tag. Like, those are all the signs I need pointing to the 11 High Noon Rider. A majority of my pick fours will be centered around that horse. Obviously, there's other horses you need to consider, Super Fast and Joe Sharp and Blarp. I know Blarp's won it at Saratoga a few times. So, definitely that's going to be the center of my play, is the 11 High Noon Rider closing into that slow pace in his last two starts.
We do not have to give away the store, JK, and say everybody you used here. Is that information in your Out of the Gate segment this week? And can folks check that out on DRF TV?
No, I just played the double with direct dial to Antino.
Okay, gotcha. Nick, how about this nightcap? How are we getting out?
You know, I thought this was – I thought the mm-hmm. here could be a little slow. And on the inner, I think in a slow-paced race, you kind of want horses that are going to be forwardly placed. I'm going to use High Noon Rider, but I'm going to also kind of center my attention on Chiltern Street and Southside Warrior. Chiltern Street is first off a claim for Robertino Diodoro. This is a horse who's gone two turns effectively in the past, almost won an allowance race at Saratoga last year where he was beaten by Coping Away at a huge price for Jaime Mejia. And Southside Warrior ran into a very tough field back in mid-April at Keeneland. He's just not going to be competitive with horses like Zenor and Forge and Revved Up, who's created stakes caliber. And he made a big move around the turn and kind of faded late. Now he's gotten his mojo back a little bit in a couple of dirt races. But getting Javier on with the kind of early speed he can show, the way this race is supposed to set up, I think he'll be in a reasonable position. I'm interested in how Super Fast is going to run. Off the claim by David Jacobson. I also wasted 2 minutes of my life watching Blarp very closely in the replay with High Noon Rider, because the char caller decided to put bottled up in there. And if somebody can explain to me how he was bottled up, then they can send me a tweet, because he had a very good trip and had nothing late. So he'll beat me.
All right. There you have it. Our thoughts on this late pick four, opening day at Saratoga. One interesting thing, we talked a lot earlier about the horse for course angle. You see, with number three, Chiltern Street, who Nick mentioned, the idea that high figure, horse has only run twice at Saratoga and has the one placing. But when you see a horse, especially a horse with, 13 starts, and they've run their career best locally at Saratoga, that's the kind of thing that sort of puts a little bit of a horse for course notion in my head, even if they don't meet the literal definition of the term. Gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to thank you both, Nick. Great job. Thank you for coming on and joining us today. JK, Great stuff as always. I look forward to talking with you more about these races as the weekend progresses. I want to thank everybody for tuning in. We're going to have a really fun lineup of shows for the Saratoga and Del Mar meets. A lot more guests and a lot of fun. We hope you'll continue to tune in, subscribe on iTunes. Leave us a review on iTunes. Helps other people find the show, and we appreciate it very much. We'll be back for a show on Tuesday. I'm Peter Thomas Fornatale. May you win all your Saratoga and Del Mar photos.